This week on Texas Scorecard Radio, what's really going on with local school tax rates? Also, Governor Abbott outflanking Lieutenant Governor Patrick on guns. And we'll hear about Austin's latest effort to divert taxpayer dollars to abortion. In our interview segment, we talk with Julie McCarty of the True Texas Project about how the grassroots can get involved and make a big difference. And we close with a commentary by Michael Quinn Sullivan on how to find the courage to get started on it all. Welcome to this week's episode of Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios in Austin, Texas. You can find us on the web, www.texasscorecard.com. If you want to follow me on social media, I'm at Tweet Tony Mac. Obviously, this goes out as a radio show, but if you're not subscribed, we have a podcast available on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Spotify. With that out of the way, we wanted to get started with this week's news and talk to Empower Texans President Ross Kessig. Lots of school boards around the state claiming credit for cutting taxes, but it's a little bit of an illusion, as you explained in one of your articles.
That's right, Tony. So taxpayers should see school property tax rates, which are set normally set by school boards, coming down in 2019. But that's happening because Texas lawmakers mandated it. It's not necessarily happening because school board trustees have all of a sudden become benevolent people looking out to protect taxpayers.
So we've seen this around the state, a lot of districts taking action to cut the local property tax rates, and they're saying, oh man, we're really making this fiscally wise decision. Give us credit, being the politicians that they are. But tell us a little bit about this legislation that came through out of the legislature, what it's requiring these districts to do.
Right. So the two components of House Bill 3 was reforming the school finance for how money is doled out to school districts, but it also had a tax relief component. And so what it essentially did is it paid for the school districts to basically lower their property tax rates. So school district property tax rates are going to be compressed or forced down in 2019, and the school districts won't lose any money. The state actually is paying $5 billion of surplus money that it had in order to buy down the property tax rate. So it's not as if school districts are going to be, lowering their tax levies. It's not like they're going to have to cut any spending. This was all, quote unquote, paid for by the taxpayers, but by revenue sources from the state.
Yeah, so the state had a pot of money, and we talked a lot about this on the program, a big surplus headed into this legislative session. One of the things that the state decided to do was dole that money out to the schools, a big portion of it, and from those funds, they have mandated a portion of this rate reduction in local schools. So you're not really seeing any change in the spending practices. Obviously, if a school has a bloated administration or has misplaced priorities, they can continue to fund all that bloated administration, misplaced priorities. But now they have some state funds coming in and then this mandate on the rates. Really interesting point you made with regard to the rates. This is a rate cut, not necessarily a substantive cut in property tax bills.
That's right. As everybody knows, what you pay in property taxes is a function of two things. It's your tax rate, which the school boards and cities and stuff control, and then it's your property appraised value from the appraisal district. So it's possible that even though tax rates on average are going to come down 8 cents per $100 of property valuation, it doesn't necessarily mean that every taxpayer is going to actually pay less in taxes. A lot of people are seeing their appraisals go up again in 2019. And so for some taxpayers, they may pay slightly less in 2019, but for most people, they're either going to pay roughly the same or even they could pay slightly more in some cases.
Yeah, and so if the value of their home is appraised at a higher value, a significantly higher value, well, then obviously these rate cuts, it's going to be offset by that increase in value. Let me ask you this. What control do school districts have to actually really reduce taxes?
Well, they have the power to reduce the tax rate further, to offset those higher property values. And we're seeing some cities and some counties doing that, where they actually are lowering the property tax rate low enough down to the effective rate to offset higher property values.
And so
ultimately the school boards have the power to lower the rate. And so it's ultimately up to them in terms of what the tax levy is and how they spend the money.
So that's something we're seeing with cities and counties, but something taxpayers can be demanding from the local school boards as well. Thanks for clearing that up for us, Ross. Now let's turn to Brandon Waltons with the Capitol Bureau. Lately, we've been talking a lot about all of these gun control proposals, and there's new developments on that front. Governor Abbott out with a proposal kind of outflanking Lieutenant Governor Patrick.
Exactly right. I mean, we've talked a little bit about this, but you've had over the past couple weeks, ever since the kind of the tragic shooting in El Paso, so you had lawmakers and really the big state leaders like Governor Abbott and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick out there saying, okay, the legislature needs to do something on this.
Do something.
Yes. Right?
That's the banner. Do something, even if something is maybe totally ill-advised.
Exactly. And so you had Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick on one hand out there. He's going on Fox News. He's sending emails to his supporters, essentially going to war with the NRA, of all people here, saying that we need to expand background checks for private sales. So if I sell a gun to somebody, I need to get the government involved and pay and do a background check.
Currently, the federal firearms licensees, the professional gun dealers, go through a background check system that the federal government runs. But now, even private citizens, if you didn't go through this system, you sold a gun to somebody, this would be potentially illegal.
Right, and this concerns a lot of groups, including the NRA, because this looks a lot like proposals from then President Barack Obama. They're calling these Obama era style proposals that would sort of create perhaps a backdoor for a gun registry, which of course is something that gun owners and Second Amendment enthusiasts have long fought against. So you have Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick on one hand doing that. Then you have Governor Abbott, who's been hosting these round tables where he's talked with these big groups about what should be done.
Including leftists. There's leftist groups there and normal people and some conservative kind of pro-gun rights people there in a round table talking about gun control proposals and other things.
He seems to have seen maybe some of the bruises that Patrick has taken in recent weeks from gunners and from conservatives in particular, and decided to seemingly take a different tack. Now, everybody sort of expected that, okay, if Patrick's out there talking for expanding background checks, Abbott's going to call for the same thing to be mandated in these legislative proposals that he has. That's not actually what we saw. Actually, what you saw in his proposal, a lot of stuff dealing with kind of crime and some criminal stuff. But then when it comes to the background checks, very carefully worded, but essentially says, we want to make it easier, more affordable for these background checks to be placed. But he made sure to mention that they would remain voluntary. At least this is how he worded it in his proposal. Very interesting to see, because this is one situation where you have Abbott seemingly positioning himself to the right of Patrick.
Yeah, so Patrick says we want to mandate these background checks on more private sales and private individuals. And Abbott very explicitly saying, no, I want these to remain voluntary, which is explicitly voluntary versus mandatory. It's a rejection of what Patrick's proposing.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Now, the devil will be in the details if this ever does come to a legislative proposal, exactly what sort of incentive that would actually look like. But a very, very interesting moment in state politics now, for sure.
Yeah, something to keep an eye on. Good to see a divide there and that we don't have unanimity amongst our Republican leadership in favor of gun control. Something very interesting.
Absolutely.
Finally, let's talk to Carrie Cheshire, Vice President for Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. Carrie, you had an article up, very interesting developments in the city of Austin, where former city councilman suing the city over abortion funding, kind of under a new law, in light of a new law. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, that's right, Tony. Don Zimmerman, who served one term on the Austin City Council, no longer serving that term, but now seeking election as state representative, is suing the city of Austin after they imposed a new controversial item in their budget, where they're providing $150,000 a year to citizens seeking abortion services to help provide for the logistics of obtaining an abortion.
Yeah, so we had this bill passed through the legislature, and people have been kind of a lot of praise celebration about it, where it was saying, look, local governments, you can't fund abortions. Yet the city of Austin's still finding ways to try and fund abortions. Tell us how that works.
Right. Of course, in the state of Texas, local governments were still funding abortion even after the state had completely divested from Planned Parenthood, stopped running contracts through Planned Parenthood a couple of years ago. And in the city of Austin, there's this swanky East Austin kind of downtown location that is leased out to Planned Parenthood for $1 a year. And that's kind of been held as, you know, by pro-life advocates as, hey, this is direct subsidy of abortion by Austin taxpayers.
Yeah, and so we saw this bill this session. It was supposed to deal with that issue, but kind of not really.
Right. So Senate Bill 22, passed by the Texas legislature, says, hey, you can't do that anymore. But the city of Austin actually extended that lease for another 20 years earlier this year before the law took effect. And then Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton said, hey, this only prevents new leases. So they will continue that dollar a year lease. But that wasn't enough for the Austin City Council. They wanted to fund abortion more. And so they put in $150,000 for the logistical cost. So, you know, say, for example, somebody wanted to take an Uber from their house to the abortion clinic to abort their child, they could be reimbursed by the city of Austin.
By taxpayer money through the city of Austin. So this new lawsuit out challenging that, saying that's illegal for the city to do it.
Right. It's saying, hey, look, not only was the intent of this recently passed law, the intent of the legislature, of which, you know, the city of Austin is a state agency, just as, you know, the Texas Retirement Service or the Texas Forestry Service.
Sure.
City of Austin's a state agency. You're not supposed to be public funding abortion. And of course, all kinds of other jurisprudence, all kinds of other questions put into the lawsuit. Probably not a good outcome going to happen with Travis County Democrat judges, but who knows?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to keep an eye on it, see what happens, and see how strong this bill that was passed in the legislative session really is.
That's right, Tony.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's news digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, it's great to have on the program this week Julie McCarty with the True Texas Project. Thanks for joining us.
I'm thrilled to be here.
So wanted to talk about your organization. People may not be familiar with True Texas Project, new name, but a stalwart organization. You have been the head for the last decade of the Northeast Tarrant Tea Party and recently made this decision to change the name and kind of refresh and renew your focus of the organization. And I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things, you know, why y'all are doing that and what some of the lessons could be from that for other folks out there who are engaged in their community. So tell us a little bit about the organization for people who maybe don't even know what a Northeast Tarrant Tea Party is or was. Tell us a little bit about that organization.
Well, obviously, you know, the Tea Party movement grew out of the response to Obama back in 2009. And it was very, very strong in Northeast Tarrant County because it is the strongest metropolitan red Republican area in Texas. And so as we started to see pressure to, you know, the things that we hold dear, all of our belief systems and values, it was a natural response. So it was actually pretty easy to grow our organization. And Northeast Tarrant Tea Party became a statewide player. You know, when people wanted to talk about politics, they wanted the opinion of Northeast Tarrant Tea Party.
Sure.
So,
and just recently you saw, we covered it on the program, State Senator Pat Fallon announcing he might run for the U.S. Senate seat against John Cornyn. Where does he make that announcement? At one of your meetings. So,
yes.
I mean, that's just kind of one little anecdote, but an example of people around the state having a lot of attention to this organization. How many, I mean, y'all have a lot of members. I mean, it's a pretty robust group.
Well, we don't, you know, honestly, everybody's always asking how many people we have. We don't have membership. We have, you know, we have an email list, which is completely different from the people that respond to us on Facebook. And that's completely different from the people that show up at, you know, block walks or whatever. It's so interesting to me that everybody has their niche and where they kind of fit in. And sure. In the end, I know we affect tens of thousands of people, but there's just not one complete list where I could say, oh, this is our membership.
Yeah, the spheres of influence, that sort of thing. So let me ask you this. I mean, obviously, you're a mother, wife, a mother. You have a career. You do a lot of things. You wear a lot of hats, yet you find time to run this organization and be a leader in your community. Why do you step up to do this as opposed to just, you know, you could just be somebody on an email list like that?
Well, honestly, everything I do goes back to the political atmosphere. So, you know, I am a homeschool mom. I must protect my rights to homeschool. I run real estate. I have real estate investments. Well, I must protect my property rights. You know, everything we do falls back to our freedoms and the need to fight for them. So it's a natural fit. And I have that personality type that, you know, don't intrude on my rights and my privacy, and I'm a very independent person. So it was a natural fit.
Yeah, kind of a don't tread on me attitude there. Well, so let's talk a little bit about the organization and some of the things that y'all have done correctly. You have a reputation of impacting campaigns and impacting local governments. Tell us a little bit about what you and it's obviously not just you, but other folks involved there are doing that is actually effective.
You know, it started off in the beginning, you know, we had Jonathan Stickland in our area, so it was really easy to motivate people to get out and block walk and phone bank and that kind of thing. And I think the more that people got involved, the more they wanted to be involved. So we launched a program almost from the get-go, the liaison program, where we assign one member of our group, not member, but, you know, one activist within our group to each elected individual in our area. I mean, from dog catcher to state Senate or U.S. Senate. So we have a constant relationship with every single elected official in our area. And then the other thing we do is our citizen advocates. So we have literally hundreds of people signed up that anytime we need to contact Austin, especially during session, but even not during session, about an issue, we have people that will go to Austin, people that will make phone calls, people that will send emails. And, you know, not everybody can do everything every time, but when you have a broad base of people willing to participate, we can make a pretty powerful impact.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, obviously you have this network of folks who are engaged now, but that had to start somewhere. A lot of people are sitting at home. They go, I care about these things too, but I don't have an army of people to activate. And so, but you didn't have an army. I mean, at some point in time, there was just a small group. So how did the group start? I guess I'm interested in that. But then how do you start a group like this?
Well, we started with 18 people. We just, you know, we sent out an email and we said, who thinks like I think? And let's talk about it. And it was just very conversational and very small. And little by little, people are telling other people, you know, everything starts small. So, you know, in 2009, that was easy. It was a new thing and people were interested. And so they naturally had a reaction to it. But, you know, here we are 10 years later. If you've not gotten involved yet, it is absolutely not too late. Just jump in. I mean, just go to a meeting, introduce yourself. You know, we have meetings once a month. There are organizations all around the state that have meetings once a month. Some of them meet once a week. Just, you know, take that step and meet some people and you'll see they're doing amazing things that you can join in.
Yeah. And opportunities there in the community to actually be involved. So I wanted to, let's just focus a little bit and talk about kind of best practices here. So obviously you've been known as the Northeast Tarrant Tea Party, and there's lots of Tea Party groups around the state and almost kind of funny, Northeast Tarrant Tea Party. So this is the Tea Party in like one corner of one county. Was a, you know, almost if you didn't know anything. And no, it turns out it's this very strong organization. Y'all have made the decision to change the name to True Texas Project. Tell us a little bit about why y'all have done that and why maybe others might do the same evaluation that y'all have.
Sure. We were actually hesitant to doing it at first. In fact, this time last year, we had a meeting with our board to talk about whether or not we would change our name and lose the Tea Party name. And unanimously, we were all like, no way. We've built our name recognition. Why would we do that? Too much work. You know, we didn't want to do it. Fast forward about 9 months past that, and the session was kind of purple, not kind of purple. It was purple. Things weren't going well. We had just endured local elections where the Tea Party name just, you know, if it was attached to a candidate, that candidate was going to lose. And so I just started doing some thinking about it and kind of changing my mind. Well, at the same time, I get a phone call from Representative Stickland, and he's like, Julie, it's time to change the name. Mm-hmm. And I was like, funny you should say that. I was just thinking that. And then I got a phone call from the former chair of the Tarrant County GOP, and he's like, Julie, let's have a conversation. I think you guys might want to change your name. And I was like, wow. So all these people I respect, you know, it's in my own head that, you know, it's time. And so we wanted to lose Northeast off the Northeast Tarrant Tea Party because it's very defining in part, you know, in terms of territory.
Yeah, if you live in Southwest Tarrant County, even that close, then you'd go, well, why would I go to the Northeast Tarrant Tea
Party? Exactly. And they would respond to us like we would make an endorsement into Arlington or something. And they'd be like, well, you're Northeast Tarrant. What do you know about Arlington?
Yeah, there's a bunch of Colleyville people trying to boss Arlington.
Exactly. Exactly. And that wasn't the case, because in reality, we have people that come from Arlington to our meetings. We have people from Frisco and Plano and Denton and, you know, all over Dallas, you know. Sure. So it didn't make sense to have Northeast Tarrant in our name anymore.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Tea Party, you know, the media has given Tea Party a bad rap. And we know that if you have Tea Party in your name, you'll easily get 25% of the vote as a candidate, because people, you know, Tea Partiers make up about 25% of the vote. But then there are all these people that agree with everything the Tea Party believes in, except the media has told them they don't, that we're too extreme.
It was an interesting thing, the Tea Party, you want to call it a phenomenon, you know, these organizations organically coming about, choosing this label, and people thought, oh, well, what is the Tea Party? As if there was like one leader or one group, is this one kind of top-down organization, and it wasn't. It was this organic movement of community groups becoming engaged. The benefit of that is, oh, it was diversified out, and you had great organizations come out of it. The downside was, I don't know, it's a very cloudy messaging. What does a Tea Party group believe? Well, I don't know. It doesn't necessarily mean anything inherently. And so I think I was seeing the same thing that you would see as far as voter labels, those sorts of things. People didn't identify as, oh, well, I'm in this Tea Party group, and that's what I want to identify with. They said, look, I support President Trump. Oh, well, it turns out that's the same,
right.
The same idea as of a local Tea Party group.
Yes, it's just very hard to talk to people one-on-one and say, well, this is what we believe. Oh, I believe that too, especially when the media is shouting at them, these are the crazies, they're too extreme, they want anarchy, you know, and it's just not the case.
Well, and I know also, obviously, Tea Party, whenever it started, a lot of groups had, it was capital TEA, taxed enough already, party. Right. But I feel like your organization is starting to focus on some things, not just, you know, taxes. Obviously, high taxes are a problem, but focusing on other issues, sovereignty, these kinds of things, which are a little far afield from taxation.
Absolutely. So, yeah, we have our, you know, our core principles are all listed on our website, but it's not all just tax related. It's, you know, like you said, national sovereignty, rule of law, you know, personal responsibility, fiscal sanity is on there. But we're not just about taxes. We cover a lot of social conservative issues and fiscal conservative issues. And, you know, people can pick and choose what they want to. We don't have a, you must sign here and believe everything that our speaker says. You know, it's pick and choose what meetings you want to come to. Just do something.
Yeah, be engaged and let's be pointed in the right general direction. What advice do you have for other? There are other Tea Party groups out there, and there are other conservative grassroots organizations, community organizations out there. What advice do you have to them that maybe they might need to hear?
I think the one thing that really led to our success is that we decided from the get-go we would not be one big gripe fest. We're not going to bring in speakers. We're not going to have an open mic where people just complain and do nothing about it. So every one of our speakers is required to have an action item. We're going to call somebody. We're going to write a letter. We're going to I don't know, read a book, something. We're going to do something besides just get angry, because there's no productivity in that. It just, eventually you're going to burn out because you're just angry at the world.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good advice. That's a lot of times on the right, we have a tendency to all get together and try and one-up each other on how bad things are, as opposed to right. one-upping each other on accomplishing things. Well, I'm excited about the direction of the group and the changes y'all are making. We're running out of time, but before we finish, I wanted to give you a chance. Tell folks, you know, if they want to get connected with True Texas Project, how do they connect with you?
Absolutely. So we have a website, truetexasproject.com. Of course, we're on Twitter and Facebook. We've also just created an account on all social, because we're getting more and more pushback on Facebook, you know, blocking things and shadow banning us and all that. So we're really trying to get people to have a diversity in terms of how they can reach out to us. But, you know, they can get on our email list from our Facebook page, from our website. They can follow all our YouTube videos, that sort of thing. So the website's the best way to start. Our calendar's always up to date.
Great. Great. Well, awesome. Appreciate you being on, Julie. True Texas Project. Go check it out. Great organization. Thanks for everything you do.
Hi, this is Kerry Cheshire with Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. Your state lawmaker probably campaigned as a conservative, as someone who would go to Austin to cut spending and limit government. But did he keep that promise? At index.empowertexans.com, you can see how your lawmaker voted on the major issues of the legislative session. Things like property tax relief, the state budget, and regulatory reform. You can also view his score on the Fiscal Responsibility Index and decide if he needs a pat on the back, a wag of the finger, or perhaps a permanent vacation from public service. The Fiscal Responsibility Index is the premier tool for taxpayers to hold their lawmakers accountable. Check us out today at index.empowertexans.com.
In this week's commentary, Empower Texans CEO Michael Quinn Sullivan touches on where we find the courage to get started on the work we are called to do.
Along the Jordan River, between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, are the plains of Jericho. The mound of the ancient city and its ruins are visible for all to see. With this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan. Today, I don't want to look at Jericho. We can discuss that place another time. Instead, I invite you to look west from Jericho, across the plains to the Jordan River and Gilgal. Not much to see out there. First, a little background. You might recall the story of Joseph and the Israelite slaves leaving Egypt. As the Egyptian army was approaching, the Israelites were pressed against the Red Sea, with seemingly nowhere safe to go. Moses was instructed by God to raise his staff, and the sea parted for the people to pass, with the waters then drowning their foes. After that amazing display of God's power, the people of Israel stumbled. They were afraid to make the final step and enter the land promised their forefather. As punishment for their faithlessness and timidity, they had to wander the desert as nomads for a generation. Some 40 years later, the Israelites were finally allowed to enter their promised land. Yet this time, the raging waters of the Jordan separated them from their potential adversaries, the closest of whom were behind the strong walls of Jericho, a city they could literally see from the swollen riverbanks. At Gilgal, the Israelites were told to do, in essence, the opposite of what they did fleeing Egypt. They were told God would turn the raging river into dry land so they could cross into the enemy stronghold, but only if they got their feet wet in the dangerous river. It's one thing to have faith when we see the waters part, providing an easy walk to safety. It's something else to have faith when crossing a raging river in order to advance into the reach of a stronger, entrenched enemy. So it was at Gilgal where the men carrying the Ark of the Covenant stepped into the raging waters, and God then dried up the river for the people to pass. Leaving the comfortable scarcity of the wilderness, they stepped out in faith toward the certain fights of claiming the long-promised land of Israel. Do we have faith to leave our safe places and fight the fights ahead? Rather than flee to safety, do we have the faith to rush into the enemy's grasp? Just as the Israelites did at Gilgal, we must with bold faith daily step forward despite our fears. I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan with the Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary.
Well, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, if you've enjoyed the show, go check out the Texas Scorecard Radio podcast, available on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Spotify. That's way you can make sure that you never miss a weekly program of Texas Scorecard Radio. If you're already subscribed, go on there and give us a 5-star review. That helps other folks find the show and get engaged. Thanks for listening.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.